Welcome, everybody, to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities, could be a force for good in all of our lives. Going.
Hey, well, you know, we're stuck in a global pandemic surrounded by street protests for racial justice. I'm doing great.
Yeah, I've actually taken a more optimistic turn since the protests have picked up in so many cities.
Yeah, so it's been a pretty heavy week. We have a really cool guest lined up who's a friend of mine and a black man who's speaking about the protests and about his personal story growing up in Roxbury, predominantly black neighborhood in Boston. But before we talk about that, Pat, what is this new initiative to get listeners more engaged in the pod?
Yeah, so we're going to try this out, see if it works. We know many of our friends and family are listening to most episodes.
My mom has to listen. I told her that. I'm going to be straight up pissed, Mom, if you don't listen.
My aunts listen all the time, and it's been, I've been amazed at how
shout out to
they,
Pat's
they jump
aunts.
Onto the...
That sounds like a merch idea, Pat. Like, Pat's yeah. aunts, what's up?
Anyway. But we want to get to know other folks and even any of our committed listeners from the start, how they're reacting to the media coverage of the protests. So what have you thought so far about the way the media has covered this? So you can mention a specific news agency, you can mention a TV station, a publication that you read.
Maybe a city. I feel like the protests look very different, let's say in Minneapolis, than New York, than LA. So maybe they can mention a particular rally that spoke to them.
Do they focus on one part over another? Is it focused on violence and fires, or is it focused on peaceful protesting? We will add this number to the episode notes and anywhere we post it, but please just go ahead and call 781-343-1813. So 781-343-1813, and just leave a reaction. So we're not asking you to ask us a question. Just go ahead and react to the way the media has portrayed the current situation in the streets.
Great. First 10 listeners that do so will receive a special gift, which is not, it will not say Trickle Down Socialism. There's a couple of cool taglines and slogans that that really speak to us about this movement. And so you will get the first 10 people who respond will be able to get that gift. So please consider doing that. And we hope you enjoy this week's episode. Yes, two white men. We basically just gave this episode over to Nate Sims, who's a great young man. And I think of him as a young man because we met when he was a senior in high school, but he's actually 32 years old. So he's not too much younger than me, but we really talk about this movement happening and what he experienced growing up. And then he attended college in the city of Boston. So we really hope that you'll listen and that you'll give us a call with your thoughts. Nate Sims, welcome to Trickle Down Socialism.
Dan, how you doing? Good, sir. Thanks for having me.
Since you and I have known each other for quite a while, maybe we could just start out by telling the listeners how you and I first met.
Yeah, well, you know, the love has always been there, man. And I definitely want to start off by saying I appreciate you for how vocal you are in your expressions through social media. I feel like your knowledge of the circumstances, the issues, are really up to par. And I feel like it shows that you have taken that onus upon yourself to really understand the history and to do the research to understand the perspectives that people have. And so it's encouraging to see things like, you know, stories that you post, messages that you reinforce. It really defines allyship. And that's how I've always really known you. You know, it's always been love, man, over the years. We met when I was in high school. You were one of the staff people at Bird Street Community Center.
The Bird. For the love of the Bird.
Yeah, I went back to work there for a few years, but, you know.
It
was short-lived, man.
Are they still kicking? I mean, are they still kicking?
Honestly, yeah, that's a whole offline conversation, too. I think they voted to close it down or something. But
that would make me sad. It's truly an institution. It's 100 years old, I think.
Bird Street is a staple in the community and has so many long-standing experiences and relationships for people that it's sad the way that it had been run into the ground by the executive director. And that's to be very honest. And
it needs to be there because that area, Columbia Road, Bowdoin, Geneva, like it's kind of a desert, so to speak, in terms of youth program.
Yeah, it's a resource. It's one of those resources that need to be protected and cultivated rather than another liquor store, you know?
Right. And so what are you up to these days?
So now I'm currently director for community and governmental affairs at Roxbury Community College. That's the long title. The short title is director for external affairs at Roxbury Community College. And beautiful. Pretty much my job focuses on really being the point person for any local, state, or federal inquiries regarding the college, nurturing relationships with certain high profile community organizations or community members and individuals. Very often if I'm brought in, it's because there needs to be a certain level of strategy or accountability, or at least expectation that something is going to be executed or facilitated in a certain type of way. So very often I'll be able to stand in place of the president to do welcomes at special events. Like I said, if the feds come through, if the governor comes through, the mayor comes through, point person, Nate Sims, I'm your guy.
That's awesome. Especially because I believe you grew up in Roxbury, correct?
Yeah, I grew up in the Bury, right in Mission Hill, off of Parker Street. I spent some years on Hillside, French Terrace, all over.
So kind of on the Mission Hill side.
Yeah, Mission Hill primarily. Mission Hill now is really a prime example of what gentrification can look like, because it has changed from being a family-oriented neighborhood to a neighborhood now where landlords necessarily don't have to keep the same standards for year to year, because they can have a bunch of college students who can move in, come in for 1 year, pay all these thousands of dollars because they have the support.
Guaranteed income.
Exactly. Guaranteed income. And it just changes.
Seems like a lot more and more the resources of home ownership are going to folks who are not from the Roxbury community.
Yes, definitely so. And that is a thing that has been historically, statistically proven, right? There are many recorded instances where banks have been known to offer loans for houses to families that are white, for example.
Redlining.
Even if they may have, yes, redlining. Yeah, exactly. That's the term for it. And so I believe similar practices have also taken place in Roxbury, and just the ability to now try to move into the neighborhood because of the increase exponentially in property values. You know, trying to get that down payment towards it, whether you have to have private mortgage insurance or not, even having your credit. There's so many different barriers that already make that upward mobility such a difficult process.
Exactly. And now, so Nate, I know you've been active with the most recent protests. I remember seeing, I think it was the day they first broke out, you told me you were like on Mass Ave or something. And can you talk about what you've been seeing on the ground? I know the media, not all media, but a lot of it seems to be fixated on the 10% or the 5% who's doing damage. Can you talk about the spirit of the protests that you've been at and like, and whether or not you feel like they're making an impact?
Yeah. You know, I have had different varying levels of experiences with the protests. My first day out there definitely taught me a lot in terms of making sure that I have the opportunity to express myself, but also trying to protect myself from any form of retribution or intimidation or things that happen to those who speak truth forward, but in a way that practices, you know, thoughts that represent the legacy of Dr. King, but also the teachings of Malcolm X and what they really stood for at their core. And I can tell you first that if you ever need to blow off some steam
go to a protest.
If you need to blow off some steam or if you feel stir crazy, there's nothing like getting out there and protesting and exercising your First Amendment rights peacefully in a controlled way. And it's beautiful. You know, I can say that when it starts, you see so many people from diverse backgrounds all coming together to stand against what is wrong, unequivocally, what is unjust and what is not fair, regardless of who you are or where you're from. And when you see that love together, you know, people are marching and there's people out there with drums and you're going to the beat. I mean, we even had a point where like people were singing this kind of song. It was like one of those chants. It was like, oh, you know, going to the drums. And that's the beautiful part, because you see people dancing and cheering with each other. But then you see the ugly side of it. You see the part where there is the anger. You see where there is the motivation and the frustration. You can see it in people's eyes. You can kind of feel it in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And it turns very tense, especially when there are aggressors, when there are those who would try to solicit certain responses from individuals through provocation. And this happens on both sides, right? From my perspective and through what I have been able to understand, there are a lot of different elements in play in terms of the group dynamics. People talk about protesters and group them together with looters and rioters. People talk about white supremacists and group them together with anti-government individuals. People talk about the state legislators and the local representative officials and group them together with the nonprofit community activists, right? But because there are all these different elements at play and some have interconnected values, the story gets mixed. And it ends up trying to be as if it's on a spectrum, either black or white. And this isn't black or white for a lot of those areas. There's a lot of gray. Right. What's black or white is what it is that has caused these things and what needs to be done to correct them. But for all the different players who have their own interests trying to either further their narrative, accomplish their own goals or their means, and whether those overlap or are parallel with what the general goal is for everyone is really what it's been like. And so, man, when you're in the singing and the dancing, it's cool. But when you're seeing, you know, the tear gas and the blood and people hurt, and that really makes it visceral. It makes it very real for you. And so I've been trying to focus on ways in which to continue to exercise my rights and to motivate others, but also apply what I feel like are my skills towards really achieving what is a tangible goal.
13 days ago, 2 full weeks ago, there was no George Floyd, right? I mean, he was a person, of course, but he wasn't in the conversation and people were stuck at home. It's not safe to go out. You know, I don't know how I feel about going out. And 2 weeks later, it's like some sort of small scale revolution, it feels like. I stole that from my boy, Bernie. You know, it does kind of feel like that. And I would just add, as a white dude, right, I can only speak from my own experience, but having 3 white children and they attended peaceful protests with me last weekend, and to be able to have conversations with white kids, because the black community has been having these conversations, right? Be safe. When you go out, you know, don't, if somebody asks you for something, you give it to them, like, be respectful. But it's like, seems like the first time that a lot of white communities actually having these conversations with their children. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's interesting because you touched on a couple of good points, right? You mentioned that before, within that 2 week time frame, it was just George Floyd and the name didn't have as much significance, right? He was a person, but not a person who was at the precipice of a revolution or a peak, and as if there was nothing before that. But the thing that should be distinguished and understood is that before there was George Floyd, there was Breonna Taylor, there was Ahmaud Arbery, there was Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, Eric Garner, there was Rodney King, there was Nelson Mandela, there was Emmett Till. There was Malcolm X, there was Martin Luther King, there was W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, Marcus Garvey, Sojourner Truth, Nat Turner. These things have always been there. Mm-hmm. The key difference for this, from my perspective, is the continual reinforcement of these images, which have been seen and perpetuated throughout the media of these unarmed people being executed, struck a different chord. Because of the sheer humanity, the relatability, it was a time where people were really able to see themselves in the position of another without what it was that their skin looks like, but because of the sheer emotion and pain and the fear that it brought in you to literally watch a person cry out for their mother and lose their life. That is an image where if that doesn't shake your heart to your core, then it's not likely that many things would move you to any type of action.
Right.
And
right.
So having these conversations take place now between white parents and their children, I think has been something that has happened as a result of it being forced upon them, right?
Okay.
These conversations are dominating every airway. And so rather than have your child be subject to information from an unfiltered source, you would want to kind of take it upon yourself to offer them some guidance and direction in how it is that they process that information. But I honestly, sincerely believe that if it wasn't out of necessity, which is what is human nature, there would have been no reason to actually change.
It wouldn't have happened.
And people don't do what they have to do unless they are forced to do it, in a sense, you know?
So we're going to actually come back to George Floyd at the end, but I wanted to shift gears a little bit. Nate, you are a product of the Boston Public Schools, and I know that you have kind of a cool story which involves a program at Northeastern University. And I was hoping you could talk about both the Boston Public Schools, which, you know, depending on the school, can look very different for certain families and children. As sometimes it depends on where you live in the city. But then how you felt like the Balfour program may have given you that boost that has helped you, and if just tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, shout out to Balfour Academy, first of all day Stafford Oblast, my second set of parents, first set of chosen parents, love you guys all day. They've been changing lives and influencing futures for generations now. So I'm just going to put that out there first for Balfour.
Awesome.
I went to Latin Academy for high school, BLA 06, and that's an exam school. I took a test to get in there. First of all, there's the impression that if you take a test, that it means you're smart. But we all know if you went to an exam school, there are some heads that were in there that you don't feel like were really the sharpest knives in the box. And so that separation already made a difference.
You're not going to name names, right?
Yeah, not gonna put anybody
that kid
out
in
there.
Biology was a total moron.
Like, wait, how did you even?
I hated that kid.
Like, how did you even make it here? But
no, but you know when you're talking to this, if they're listening, they know who they are.
Exactly. Because once you get in there, you're like, okay, now I can kind of see the difference. But it prepares you because it was very rigorous. Yeah, pretty much like varsity, and it was on a level where the workload and the quality of the teachers was similar to what you would experience in a college type environment.
Right.
Hence it kind of being an exam school, even though you have to take a test to get in there. But what it was underlying were the ways in which it also prepared you for some of the underlying systemic institutionalized issues that you would deal with being in college, right? Being part of a limited minority, for example. I know that there was, although my school would be considered diverse, there was only a handful of Black males that graduated in my class. And Latin Academy, they accepted students at two points, coming into seventh grade and coming into ninth grade.
Right.
And if I recall, I was one of maybe less than 10 students that were Black males that came in as ninth grade. And I don't even remember any other Black males. There might have been one or two that may have graduated with me that came in from ninth
and
grade.
And it's sink or swim.
Be rich.
So how did Balfour work its way into that as you got the challenge and you had to decide, can I rise to this challenge, right? How did Balfour sort of like swoop in and kind of like support you with that?
Balfour came in as that primary motivator and system of support that gave me the skills and the confidence to feel like I could achieve what I needed to. I had not gotten honor roll in school before I started Balfour.
Never.
But in my last year of middle school, I got honor roll at the Timilty after my first year at Balfour.
That's so cool.
Every summer, I would spend my time learning about sports and building relationships and focusing on family while also getting enriching classes in Spanish and in English and in math. I had a chance to take the SAT at least two or three times before I actually had to take it first. And, you know, statistically speaking, the more you take a test, the better you'll do. And Balfour provided that type of structure where it reinforced the importance of education and provided the elements of me, the elements of community and what is really necessary for people to be able to be successful.
Right. So I want to shift gears again and talk about police. This is kind of a precarious conversation, but I will say, as a white dude, I've had numerous interactions with police. I've probably been pulled over 10 to 15 times in my life. And I've been in police cars, but that's not the point of the story. I would just say that most of my interactions, even when I've been in a police car, have been respectful. I never feared once for my safety. And I wonder, as a black man, do you have a story?
You know, the first thing that comes to mind, as soon as you say that, I'm going to be honest with you, is fuck the police. That's the first thing that comes to mind because of the way that my culture has been. Mm-hmm. And that's just a natural impulsive response to it.
Right.
But luckily, my ability to be a rational, logical thinking individual and my knowledge of criminal justice, which I have a bachelor's in, lets me know that that is not an appropriate phrase to categorize all police.
Correct.
Because I do know good officers and officers who do focus on reinforcing what it really means to be an officer who protects and serves. However, because of the lack of accountability and acknowledgement on part of their peers, that makes them culpable. And there is the negligence, which is that the enforcement is not being applied to the area where it should be applied to the highest standard, as opposed to the lowest standard. If you are the enforcers of the law should be enforced to the highest standard within your own divisions. And so,
like integrity, you should be the highest level of integrity.
Exactly. You can consider the fact that officers who go to a police academy don't necessarily have as much time spent educationally towards the pursuit of that degree relative to someone in med school, right? Or relative to someone who's going to law school. So how does it make sense that you have the ability to take a life often without impunity, but the equivalent of time that you go to school is not even near to a person who preserves life or a person who understands the actual intricacies of the law? And so with the understanding of police dynamics and those experiences, I have a hyper awareness of police. This is built in. It's a survival thing. Anywhere that I go or I am, driving, walking, if a police officer or vehicle comes within to my view, I don't have any choice. I can't turn it on or turn it off. If they're behind me, if they're up the street, and that is because of a built-in inherent fear of the unknown that I could potentially be doing absolutely nothing. I could be committing a crime. I could not be committing a crime. I could have a record. I could not have a record. I could be jogging, walking, sleeping, breathing, not breathing. And it's possible that I may lose my life. And when you have that type of system that represents such a dual perception, when that perception is only supposed to be one that is supposed to protect and to serve and reinforce the standards of society, that's a hypocrisy at its core. Because it is not representing that. That is only reinforcing the same type of views people have towards elitism, the difference between those who have and those who have not, right? Mm. And that's what it represents towards me, because within every area of means, whether it is financial, educational, health, physical, any of those areas, there are the disparities and the negative representation for people of color, for Black men and women, whether it's we have more degrees or less degrees, or you get paid more or you get paid less, or you have more health insurance or not health insurance. And so having those experiences with police for me, it's heart-wrenching, right? Because I don't know if I do the right thing completely. I can still be subject to being wrongfully arrested, wrongfully tried and convicted, and wrongfully spend time in jail. That's what the police represent. It's so much more than just individual interaction, because I've had times where I've been profiled by police officers, where I've had questions directed towards me. I can tell you an example. Do you want to hear a very specific one real quick?
Yeah.
So there was a time when I was in college, I went to Northeastern University, and Northeastern University, they're going to pay their due too as well. it's only for so long that they're going to be able to try to fill the world with insubstantial stuff, but the time's going to come for everybody to really make actual tangible change, and they're going to be held accountable to the same standard as well. And basically, long story short, NUPD are deputized by the Suffolk County. So,
oh, so they got can guns?
Essentially. Oh, yeah. Do they have guns? Yeah. They have assault rifles. NUPD, their officers are able to have assault rifles. And it was a big issue a few years ago.
That's crazy.
Because I think there was one of the school shootings that happened at a college. And then they're like, okay, why are you arming these people at Northeastern here in Roxbury?
Seriously.
So anyways, this is during maybe like my sophomore or junior year. And I'm out on the street with two friends of mine. One is one of my childhood friends who I grew up with, black dude. The other one is Spanish dude, lighter skin, who I had met at college from Florida. Really good dude, though, right? We're outside, and we're actually about to go upstairs to another friend's place. You know, he's having a little bit of a get-together. And next thing you know, police officers pull up to us. And I'll never forget this officer's face, because I ended up working with him at Northeastern, too. And you don't think that he would ever remember me, but I remember him.
Of course.
And anytime he tried to interact with me, I would keep it 100 with him. Like, don't speak to me, because now that you see me in a suit, you think it's a little bit different, but I'm still that same person that you profiled.
Yeah, still black.
So he came up to us,
dude.
Yep. Questioning us, asking us, oh, what are you guys doing out here? Oh, so-and-so. Like, we're just standing there, right? I'm not sure if he has a report or any type of probable cause. Not like it would matter anyways, because they can falsify reports or make things up. That happens. And it leads to him separating us. But here's how he separated us. He took my Spanish friend and had one of his cops, he's like, here, go with him over here, and separated me and my black friend Rob,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And he asked us, oh, are you guys trying to sell him drugs? Very directed, very pointed question.
Weird. Yeah.
First of all, if drugs are coming into the community, they're not coming in at this level, really, from the black dudes in the hood trying to sell it to the college white boys. No, it's coming in at a whole different level from the borders, from the other white dudes who have the corporate connections and ability to transport that type of stuff in.
Yes, right.
And we have a back and forth, like, you're questioning us about things when we're just standing here minding our business. And after a while, there was nothing that he could do. We didn't commit any crime. He walks away. We're like, yeah, man, have fun harassing black people. He tries to come back and talk about, oh, no, I'm just thinking this and thinking that. It's like, no, man, save all that. And come to find out after, when I asked my Spanish friend what was going on, he said, oh, he asked me if y'all were trying to sell me drugs. The inherent bias within that to separate us along racial lines and to assume that these drugs are coming in from this source to that source.
Yeah. When
it's actually potentially the opposite, right? You have some college white boys who will be some of the best suppliers or connects. I mean, I got into college and these dudes had contacts and weight that I wasn't even aware of growing up, being born and raised here in Boston. So even just having that difference and then not understanding the dynamics for it. And you think that officer ever had to go through some extra type of training? You think anyone taught him a lesson about that or let him know that he should never judge a book by its cover? And it's just funny because in that situation, the Spanish friend would have been the one who would probably have more weed in the first place, even if that was the case.
Right. And what you're talking about sounds a lot like stop and frisk.
I was being black and standing outside.
Right. You weren't. You know, walking back and forth. You weren't in a tinted car with the windows up. You were standing.
Just a guy on the street.
Right.
Just a guy on the street. And honestly, stop and frisk is a joke. It's just another way that there can be institutionalized legislation that allows for the harassment and disenfranchisement of black people. I think it's a very poor model to look to the government to be the one to set the trend for what is morally correct and incorrect. It is on the people to put that pressure on the government, because there was a time on the books where you have Jim Crow laws, where you have where it's illegal for black people to read. It's illegal for black people to vote. It's illegal for women to vote. And so it's like, you can't look at the government for that standard and say, oh, well, if the government has this in place right now, this is what it is. That's right. No, because statistically and historically, the government has been by far the highest level of aggressor or justifier in the killing of people from underrepresented populations.
Exactly.
And that's a historical fact. And no one can argue that. They change when we, the people, force them to change to that standard for any type of rights mm-hmm. at all protected under mm-hmm. civil rights.
Right. That's an important point. Thank you for raising that. Nate, this morning from Boston Globe, there's a story about Tim Duncan, who is the
Yep, I know Tim Duncan. What happened to him in Newton?
Oh my gosh, you got to read this article.
Athletic assistant, or deputy athletic director at Northeast University.
He was in Whole Foods in Newton the end of May. I'll paraphrase because, again, we don't have time to discuss it here. A bunch of cops surrounded him. One of them pulled a gun in a Whole Foods in Newton, which I don't know if you've been, but they aren't too dangerous of a place. Turns out he's just being black in Whole Foods. Check out the Boston Globe, Tim Duncan from Northeastern, if you have any reservations about whether or not black people get profiled on the regular. Last thing, and this is kind of a heavy question, but I just encountered this yesterday. I was reading an article and it was included Candace Owens, who's a conservative black woman. And she is been very vocal, as have others, about the record or the past decisions, shall we say, of George Floyd.
Honestly, first of all, Candace Owens is a house Negro. And I'm going to say Negro because I guess that's the more appropriate term to use it. But if you're a white listener and you don't know that phrase, then you can ask one of your friends of color about it. But just make sure you ask their permission to use the word Negro. And if you're a black listener, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think people in her position are planted there directly just to sow discord and dissension, right? To try to diverge people's point of views, to focus on aspects of something that are minute and do not matter. It is a regular tactic used by the defense or a prosecution in any type of case to discredit the character of a witness, of a person on the opposing side. And very often the discredit is used to justify whatever it was that was done to them, or to justify why they are not in the right for whatever it is that they are seeking. Mm-hmm. And so bringing up elements of George Floyd's life and his criminal record, whether he was committing a crime or not, whether he was black, whether he was white, whether he had a history or didn't have a history, had a gun or didn't have a gun, it doesn't matter. Because statistically speaking, he would have been more likely to have been killed either way, whether he had a record or did not have a record, whether he had a licensed firearm or not a licensed firearm, whether he was actually walking or whether he was actually jogging. And so when these tactics and strategies are used, it's because the intent is to try to justify the lesser treatment that is supposed to be representative of a system that upholds society's laws and standards, when in fact you are only adding justification for murder, for an execution. And I guess it just depends on what lines it is, whether it's the state that does it or whether it's an individual that does it. But people have rights to defend themselves and the state has a right to protect us. But at what point do those lines get blurred to the point that everything that the state does is right for the state to be able to persecute people and allow them to not speak their minds freely or to be able to allow some type of sanctioned killing like that? Those are elements that are used to really detract from the larger picture. And if you really know what you're talking about, you know it's not just about George Floyd.
Right.
It's not just about his criminal history. It's about everything that came before that. It's about these ways that the system continues to perpetuate these microaggressions. And it's not just one large system. So it's not like people can think about it as just one entity. It's like the Fed. That's just it. No, it's 30,000 these are the words from Sean King. It's all these local police precincts and local district attorney's offices.
In a lot of places.
Sheriffs and judges. Yeah. Right. And that's really what it is. So, you know, I pray for Candace Owens and hopefully sometimes she can come to see the light. But very often you'll have the people who look like us that will be some of our worst oppressors. Mm. And I commend my brothers who are in blue, right? Because they may have a motivation to want to be out there to change the perception that people have toward police. But often, sometimes they are even harsher on our people than whites are. You know, it's like the overseer in the field is the black dude, because you know that they're going to try to curry favor with their superior or with their false viewed superior and their master at the expense of their own people. And that's exactly what Candace Owens is doing to try to position herself as well to detract from George Floyd.
It's sad, but I appreciate people like you, you know, speaking out and not losing the faith. And I just admire your story. As someone who's an educator, you know, a lot of us do great work as educators, but actually I think the bigger point is when a child or a young person takes it upon themselves, right? An education, sadly, is not something that happens to you. It's something that you have to grab, you know, you have to grab onto. It's like a verb. You have to educate yourself. And I've seen you do that over the years. And, you know, you're still a young, what are you, 28, 29?
I'm 32, man. But thanks. You know, I think I could pass, though.
Listen. Well, because we're closer, because I met you when you were rather old. You were 17 or 18.
Yeah, I was like 17, 18.
Right. So I turned 40 this year, and I think it's great. I'm excited to turn 40, but yeah. I'm still relatively young. So when I talk to my students, I'm like, I said to a student the other day, what are you, 25? And she was like, Dan, I'm 22. And I was like, close enough.
It blurs together.
I regularly, and that's what I just did to you also, I regularly lose 3 years of my life. I don't know if if I blacked out, maybe I had a really good time for 3 years. I don't know.
Like, I just carry it well. You know, I appreciate that, man. I get it all the time.
But I would love to have you back. I actually had no idea. I should do my research on my interviewees, but I had no idea you were at RCC as a school counselor in the Boston Public Schools. I believe that community colleges could be the next big sort of tipping point. If we can extend, if we can do, I don't know if you ever heard of K-16 education. In Chicago, they have several schools now that are high school right through associate's degree. So it's like a one seamless thing. I would love to talk to you more about it. And I know there's a lot of leaders like Andrea Campbell, who was on the show last week, who I think would support that. And I think that community colleges often get shortchanged, again, due to bad stereotypes and misunderstandings about what they are and what they are not.
Yeah, small plug on that, actually. Community colleges are one of the best resources used to get people back to work through workforce certifications and professional development. And statistically, when unemployment rates increase, the enrollment rates for community college increase, because it's one of the best resources that people can use to streamline. And that's happening
right
now,
right? I mean, as the unemployment rate has doubled, I think it's tripled, actually, or quadrupled. Have you seen
that?
It's
like 40 million people.
On your end, on the enrollment side?
People are trying to get educated. They want to see how they can be in a position where they could work remotely, for example, right? If you don't have to be at a work, but you know you need a certain type of certification to be within this field to get a certain type of salary, it's like you go to where you can to get the skills. And that's what we have. That's what Roxbury Community College represents. It's a treasure trove of knowledge representative of Black and brown people in Roxbury. And it's something we have to fight for, because it's subject to the same types of attacks and disenfranchisement that we all face at all levels.
Right, and it also shatters the myth that folks in low-income neighborhoods are sitting at home trying to wait for their government check to come. If you give them opportunities to get better, they will get better, right?
Exactly.
There's an expression in education that we use all the time, and it's kids learn when they can. So if a kid can't, it doesn't mean they won't or they don't want to. It just means that you need to remove a barrier, or maybe give them a little kick in the seat, you know, like a little push forward, and then they will. But saying, you know, well, they can't learn or they just want their check misses the point. But we are over time. My co-host Pat will curse me, but I think he will actually really enjoy this conversation. I would love to have you back again, and I really appreciate what you've done and what you continue to do. And final thing, what you just described with using government resources to support a community college and re-educate folks and support them sounds a lot like socialism. And the point of our show is to point out that, in fact, the United States is a socialist system. It just benefits corporations and rich folk. And to the extent that we change that, if we can flip it on its head, then maybe some of those resources will trickle down to the folks who really need it.
It's an inherent observation. You know, I think trickle-up economics would be good too, but trickle-down socialism sounds nice.
I'll tell you what, Nate, you start that podcast, I'll be on, and we can debate. We can go back and forth between shows and debate whether it's up or it's down, okay?
Yeah. Well, no, I think the way that you have it in the terminology is actually correct, because if it's trickle-down socialism, that sounds better than trickle-down economics. You know, so I think we're definitely on the same page. And thank you for having me too, Dan. You know, I really appreciate you, man. You've always been a good, solid dude, always keeping in touch over the years, looking out, always trying to support the brothers. You know, you're definitely one of those people where if anyone ever had to say who was invited to the cookout, this is the cookout right here.
Yeah.
You showed up.
I get to come to the black cookout?
Bro, you came already to the cookout and you brought the potato salad with the seasoning. That's how it was proper. You know what I'm saying?
And I ate the collard greens. You know, I've had collard greens multiple times and I don't like them and I'm afraid to say that, but maybe I just need to be at the better cookout. Maybe somebody,
you know what, Dan?
Somebody put too much salt or something. I don't know.
Honestly, I don't really like collard greens either. You good. You just be you. Just having the awareness of it.
from the capitalist system we live in that like white folk can't like collard greens. I don't know.
What's important is that it doesn't even matter if you like them or not. Just to have that choice to be able to say it, you know.
Okay.
And I really appreciate you for having me. You know, power to the people. Everybody stay safe out there. Remember, it's better to focus and stay united rather than to be divided.
That's right. Peace and love, Nate. See you next.
This week's episode is brought to you by the Grassroots Law Project. The Grassroots Law Project bridges the gap between grassroots organizing and legal expertise in criminal justice reform by bringing millions of us together to address the most pressing and egregious failures of the system, hold powerful actors accountable, and advocate for deep structural change. With the help of a vast grassroots network, we will provide the necessary organizing and legal support to transform justice in America. To learn more or make a donation, please visit www.grassrootslaw.org.
These racist cops have got to go!
Hey, hey! Ho, ho! These racist cops have got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Racist cops have got to go, hey, hey. Whoa. These racist cops have got to go, hey, hey. Whoa, ho. These racist cops have got to go, hey, hey. Whoa, ho. These racist cops have got to go, hey, hey. Whoa, ho. These racist cops have got to go, hey, hey. Whoa, ho. These racist cops have got to go, hey, hey.